Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Phyllis Schlafly is an icon, a regular on the American scene. She, an attorney, the founder of the Eagle Forum, eagleforum.org, and numerous other organizations over the years. She stunned the political establishment by stopping the Equal Rights Amendment in its tracks, for example. Author of Feminist Fantasies, it was published in 2003, the mother of six. Phyllis Schlafly, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Great to have you on our program. The thing that I wanted to bring you on and talk about is this piece that you wrote in early November, America Wants Marriage, But the Courts Don't. But looking at your website, I think that there's a whole variety of things that we could be discussing. But first, let's just talk about this. I don't want to put words in your mouth. How would you characterize this whole issue of gay marriage and the involvement of federal judges?
The column you're referring to had particular reference to the schools. Is that right? The schools, which are a powerful impact on our culture today.
Actually, you said judges won't be satisfied until they've remade our society to reflect their liberal-leaning agendas, warns the author of The Supremacists.
Well, that's right. And that's why George Bush went around the country when he was running for president saying, we will not stand for activist judges who are legislating from the bench and remaking our culture through court order.
Yeah.
And that's what they've done. And on the gay issue, the opening blast was Lawrence v. Texas a couple of years ago, where the Supreme Court really declared sodomy a constitutional right, practically.
Didn't they essentially say that what consenting adults do in the privacy of their own bedroom is none of the business of government? And what's wrong with that?
Well, the issue was the Texas anti-sodomy law.
Right.
And the question is does that violate the Constitution?
Right.
And the judges could find nothing in the Constitution to prohibit Texas from having that law. Now, most states didn't have that law anymore, but Texas and a few did. And the judges wanted to impose their view about our culture and wanted to throw out the law, and there was no constitutional basis for that. So that's the first time when they really went to foreign sources. And they cited the British Parliament, the European Court of Human Rights, and some brief filed by some UN High Commissioner. And about,
you're talking about Breyer's concurring opinion in that. In that case.
Well, I think it was a Kennedy majority opinion.
Because
there's nothing in.
But the question again, I mean, what is right about the government coming into your bedroom or my bedroom and saying, hey, wait a minute, we don't like the sexual position you're using or the consenting adult that you're having sex with? What's right about that?
Suppose it's being performed on a child. Is that
that's
okay?
That's not what the case was about.
No, that's not. But you're asking why they should come in the bedroom. And just because you don't have a right to commit murder or pedophilia or illegal drugs
But we're talking about sex between consenting adults. What is right about the government, our government, coming into your bedroom or my bedroom and telling you or me that we can or cannot do a particular type of sexual activity with a consenting adult?
Well, the American people have got a right to make laws in their states regulating human behavior.
That was made in the
same-sex marriage. They can regulate sodomy. They can regulate polygamy, pedophilia, and a dozen other things. And that is part of our democratic process. And if you don't like that, the thing for you to do is go to the Texas legislature and get them to change the law. It's not to have some activist judge impose its view upon us.
So you're of the opinion that when the founders wrote the word freedom into the Declaration of Independence and into the preamble of the Constitution, that they did not mean the freedom of consenting adults to do whatever they wanted in their bedrooms.
That's right. Of course they didn't mean that. Although they had a number of different religious denominations and a number of states had established religions, what they had in common was a code of civil behavior that they all adhered to, and that was a given.
It seems to me, Phyllis Schlafly, that your argument in favor of the government coming into our bedrooms is in contradiction to your assertion that you are a conservative.
Well, you can define conservative your way, and I can define it my way. It's not up to you to say what my view of conservative is.
Well,
nor is there any law that proclaims that we all have to adhere to the same definition.
Well, that's certainly true. I guess I was using Russell Kirk's definitions from his 1953 book, The Conservative Mind. You know, basically the classic definitions.
And I certainly do believe that state laws should regulate a lot of behavior and prohibit it, whether it's illegal drugs or same sex or polygamy or pedophilia, or going down the list. I think the state legislatures have every right to do that. And if you want to change, you go to the legislature and get them to change it.
Okay. You on your website, eagleforum.org, Phyllis Schlafly, you have, Mr. President, take off your puppet strings and get off your knees to the globalists and stop selling out your own country, my country. You are becoming a disgrace. Tell us about this.
Well, I must be quoting somebody else. That's not my language. But I do think that it is very curious the way George Bush is trying to move for integration of the three North American countries. He announced this with a press release at Waco in March of 2005, and then he reaffirmed it in Cancun this year. And now we find that unbeknownst to most of the American people, in the Department of Commerce, they have set up a government website called spp.gov where they tell about the groups of people from Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. that are rewriting our administrative law. And I think the American people ought to know about this. I think there should be a congressional investigation. And if somebody's changing our laws or our regulations without our knowing about it, I think we ought to find out and get it out on the table.
I agree with you. And one of the things that baffles me is why the issue of, and this actually in many ways goes back to George Herbert Walker Bush's assertion of the New World Order. It goes to Bill Clinton's embracing NAFTA and GATT and the WTO and basically overriding domestic law with international trade policies that give our trade the ability for us to make trade rules to multinational corporations. And now to George W. Bush with this meeting with Harper and Fox that they had down in Waco in March of 2005 and what has come out of it, this security and
prosperity partnership.
Thank you. The Security and Prosperity Partnership, which SPP. .gov, I mean, an official government website for the thing. It's not like they're trying to keep it secret. Why isn't the mainstream media talking about this, number one? And
that's
number two, why are not conservatives and liberals in an outrage about it?
Well, the people who read the Phyllis Schlafly Report are outraged about it, and they know about it, but I wish you'd answer the question of why the mainstream media are not touching it.
I think it's because the mainstream media is owned by big multinational corporations who are going to be the prime beneficiaries of it.
Right, and all they want is the cheap labor. They just can't see any farther than that. They want the cheap labor. They want to keep bringing them in. And we live in a global economy, and we've got to compete. No, we don't have to compete with people who make 30 cents an hour. It's up to our government to protect us against those people.
Amen. But now you're taking a liberal position. I mean, you're taking the position that populists in the 1870s were taking all the way up through Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, it always was the policy of the Republican Party to protect American jobs against foreign unfair competition until Franklin Roosevelt came along with Cordell Hull. And they're the ones who were the big promoters of this so-called free trade. And now the Republicans, a lot of them have picked it up. Big businesses picked it up. And I think there's no such thing as a free lunch, and I sure do believe in protecting American jobs against the people who make 30 cents an hour.
Yeah, I've, broadly, it's interesting. From the 1770s through the 1790s or so, it definitely wasn't the policy of the Republican Party. They were gung-ho in favor of, for example, the railroads importing Chinese to work on the railroads. But then, you know, with Teddy Roosevelt, it once again became the policies of the Republican Party to protect. And then you had this very liberal Republican, Dwight Eisenhower, who was a protectionist. But so interesting, you're calling to take it back. I you know, it's funny, the confluence, or interesting to me, the confluence. Yeah, there's obviously areas where we just strongly disagree, gay marriage, for example. But other areas where, you know, what's best for this country, that conservatives and liberals can actually find some common ground.
Right, and it really gives you pain the way they have tried to give new definitions to language. Now, free trade. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Somebody's giving you something free, I think there's a joker in it somewhere.
Yeah. No, it's free for the corporations.
And they've tried to make protectionism a dirty word, but I do believe in protecting American jobs.
Amen. Okay, Phyllis Schlafly, I never thought I'd agree with you. EagleForum.org, great to have you on the program.
Have a good day.
Thank you, you too. Phyllis Schlafly. Oh, my. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Number 1-866-440-8466. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. We'll be right back.
Every time we think about same-sex parents, oh, my gosh, we exclaim. I mean, to people who want to provide a protective and nurturing family environment, have they no shame? It's so deviant. It's the Lord's holy word, as my second wife said to my third. That a family's based on obligation and fear. We're defenders of marriage, connubial narcs, ever vigilant and patriotic patriarchs. Defenders of marriage, defending the institution against people who want to get married.
Yes. When my woman was doing welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with me. What I find particularly fascinating about that conversation with Phyllis Schlafly, who is out promoting her new book, by the way, The Supremes, and I should have, just as a matter of courtesy, mentioned it during the interview, just to slip by. But is that, on the one hand, she is promoting, and, well, not even specifically Phyllis Schlafly. Well, yeah, okay. She's promoting a certain type of bigotry, in my opinion. She wouldn't characterize it as that, I'm sure. And I, one of the things that I very much try to do is when I have people on who I disagree with, not to then use the bully pulpit of this microphone after they're off the air to beat them up. You know, I prefer to beat people up while they're capable of defending themselves while they're still in the air. So I don't mean this as a way of, you know, name calling or hurling invective at or whatever. That's not my goal here in dissecting that conversation. But there is, what I find particularly fascinating about this, and I see the same thing with Pat Buchanan and a number of other people on the right, not the pragmatic right, not the Newt Gingrich right, the power at any cost, we'll get in bed with corporations, we'll use language to manipulate the public right, not the cynical right, the Newt Gingrich right, and not the ideological right of Elliot Abrams and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl and Doug Feith and Jeb Bush and Dick Cheney, the right that believes that America should be an empire and that democracy is a nice idea and we should give it lip service, but we actually don't want to have a democracy. We actually want to have a meritocracy, an aristocracy run by essentially the rich and the bright. Not that right. But there's a third right out there. And that's the right that's represented by people like Phyllis Schlafly and Pat Buchanan, who have their areas where, much like the Republican Party, they appeal to what I would, as I said, what I would characterize as a bigoted cross-section of America. In Phyllis Schlafly's case, it's anti-gay sentiments, which, you know, in my mind, this is pure and simple, nothing more than a civil rights issue. And obviously she disagrees. And in Pat Buchanan's mind, immigration, you know, again, he views this, his concern is that America is going to become browner and browner, and oh my God, what's that going to do to our culture? That, in my point of view, is a culturalist and racist argument. My concerns about immigration, frankly, have to do with what it's doing to the labor force in the United States. And I think that that's true of every country. Every country has, you know, immigration policies that have to do that. But back to the point. The point is that what I'm seeing, once you cut past the bigoted rhetoric, for lack of a better word, is populism. And increasingly, I believe that the transformation that we're seeing in the American landscape, the American political landscape, and we're watching this happen right now, on the left and the right, is that the old doctrinaire categories of I'm on the right or I'm on the left are breaking down. The libertarians versus the conservatives, for example, on the right. You know, Phyllis Schlafly will find no shortage of conservatives, in quote. I mean, hard conservatives, doctrinaire conservatives, who say, you know, the Texas sodomy law should have been struck down. It's, you know, the government has no business telling us what to do in our bedrooms. We want less government, not more government. And, of course, you'll find a lot of liberals who agree with that, myself included. Not the we want less government, we want more government. What we want is smart government, not dumb government, frankly, regardless of its size. We want, how much government do we want? Just enough. It's the old joke, Abraham Lincoln, who was very tall, was once asked, how long should a man's legs be? And he said, long enough to reach the ground. I mean, it's just how much government should we have? We should have enough. But what we're seeing now is the emergence of populism. And I find it just fascinating, this idea that the agenda, yes, there is nuance in our agenda about social issues, about whether gays should be allowed to marry or I mean, you know, just as there was social nuance 40 years ago about whether people of different races should be allowed to marry, or 60 years ago about whether people of different races should be allowed to eat in the same dining hall, on and on. I mean, as I said, I think this is a civil rights issue, pure and simple. And I don't believe that these judges are activist judges. I believe that they're simply interpreting the law. And I find the word freedom in the Constitution and in the Declaration of Independence to be pretty unambiguous. And I believe the founders thought of it that way as well. And frankly, I suspect the tolerance for gays back in that era was as great or greater than it is now, although gay marriage was not sanctioned. But nonetheless, this idea of populism, of we the peopleness, is emerging, and emerging significantly, and I think it's an important force to notice, and that the politicians who fail to do so at their own risk. And certainly it's something that the Democratic Party needs to be embracing. I want to talk to you also about, what does it mean to be a democracy? Why is the United States the 17th most significant democracy in the world? That and your calls right after this, 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Which color pill are you going to take today? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-THOM. Our telephone number. Mark in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hey, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you doing? For taking my time.
Sure.
I am.
Mark, you're breaking up really badly. I'm assuming you're on a cell phone, so I'm going to put you on hold, and maybe if you're driving, it'll sound a little better in a little bit. We'll come back to it. Rance in Fallon, Illinois. Hey, Rance.
Hey, great show.
Thank you.
I just wonder if your guest and her right-wing political friends have ever heard of a document called the U.S. Constitution, and if so, why are the politicians trying to go against their oath of office to the Constitution by trying to subvert it?
Well, keep in mind, she brags about stopping the Equal Rights Amendment. Her idea of equal rights I don't want to put words in Phyllis Schlafly's mouth, but let's just say broadly, the worldview that historically fought against the right of women to vote, which was passed with the 19th Amendment in 1920, as I recall, that fought against the ability of African Americans to participate in civil society throughout the history of this country, but particularly, through the Emancipation Proclamation, through Reconstruction, through legal apartheid, in 1896, where you had the Supreme Court case was that led to legal apartheid, all the way up to Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, and then the Civil Rights Act. They fought all of these things all the way. Thought that Earl Warren should be impeached because he was how dare he allow African Americans into civil discourse. 1973, fought against the rights of women with regard to Roe v. Wade. Historically, they've always fought against the rights of people, against expanding freedom and democracy, and yet they call themselves conservatives and constitutionalists. Makes no sense to me.
Yeah, well, they're trying to subvert the Constitution in two ways. I was listening to your guest, and these two ways popped in mind. First, they're trying to pass their religious views as laws, whether it's anti-evolution laws, anti-abortion laws, anti-gay laws. That's, to me, solely unconstitutional to make your religious beliefs law of the land.
Right.
And secondly, when they talk about activist judges, if you look in the Constitution, that is their job. Their job is to take a look at the laws that is made by the Congress and signed off by the President to make sure that they don't violate the Constitution. And if so, they're overruled. They're not being activists. They are doing their job as defined in the Constitution.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. It's actually, that's not how their job is defined in the Constitution. That's how their job was defined by the Supreme Court in 1803 or 1804 in the Marbury versus Madison case, when Chief Justice John Marshall, who is Thomas Jefferson's cousin and bitter enemy, he was appointed by John Adams on his way out of office in 1800 as a slap to Jefferson. And Marshall ruled that the Supreme Court had the right to strike down laws made by Congress and judge the constitutionality of a law. But it doesn't say that in the Constitution.
Okay,
but it is historical precedent, so it is the law right now, Rance.
I stand corrected. But the point is that if 90% of the U.S. population is Christian and they want a law and get one passed saying that all non-Christians are not entitled to any government benefits, I would expect these so-called activist judges to shoot that down in a heartbeat.
That's right. You're absolutely right. Their job is, by definition, whether it's, the Marbury versus Madison or the Constitution or both, actually, their job is by definition to determine whether these laws are appropriate and to be active. We have three branches of government, and all three are expected to be active. Good point, Rance. Thanks a lot for the call. Go ahead. Nope. Okay, that's it. Phil in Chattanooga. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's an honor to talk to you. I listen to your show all the time that I download from Air America.
Mm-hmm.
And I've posed a question to you before by email, but I never have gotten an answer to it. I live in the buckle of the Bible Belt and Republican-controlled everything here. And, all the time I'm encouraged to... by you to contact my congressman and senator, and my congressman is Zach Womp. He's a straight hardline, votes everything party line every time, with George W. Bush. And what really good does that do to contact people that just don't even want to listen to any kind of any of the stuff that you talk about on your program?
Well, first of all, let them know that you're there. Richard Nixon was actually seriously considering. Well, let me back up a little bit. There was this huge rally, almost a million people who showed up on the Mall in Washington, D.C., an anti-war protest in 1970, whatever the year, I think it was 73. And just a massive, massive protest. And people calling on Nixon to stop the war. Nixon did not stop the war. Those people who participated in that went home feeling like they had failed. They hadn't done any good. We learned after Nixon left office and after the tapes came out that Nixon and Kissinger had actually been planning to use tactical nuclear weapons in Vietnam a month after that protest was scheduled. In other words, they were scheduled to do it in 30 days. As a consequence of that protest, Nixon and Kissinger decided not to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam. So even though there was no apparent and obvious response, in other words, Nixon didn't say, okay, you got me, I'm going to change my behavior, he did change his behavior as a consequence of people standing up and speaking out. So number one, I would still contact even the most right wing of representatives and say, hey, wait a minute, this is, you represent me, and this is my opinion. and believe that, you know, over time there's a possibility they can change, number one. Number two, I'd say even more important than that is that you show up at the local Democratic Party headquarters, and if there's a local Green Party, I mean, as many as you, for that matter, the Republican Party, if you want to infiltrate them and take them over and be a force for good inside the Republican Party, although most folks can't stomach that. But there are some Republicans of goodwill. But show up at the Democratic Party headquarters and say, I'm here. How can I help? You know, I'll give you 3 hours a week, or I'll give you 3 hours a month, or, you know, I'll just show up for the meetings and vote or whatever. But get involved in the local political activities. That's how you end up taking back a party, and that's how you end up accomplishing something, and then you end up with somebody representing you who you can talk to.
Well, you know, I appreciate all that, and I have been to the local Democratic Party meetings, and you know, very inspired by you to do so and to get active. You know, you're the one that got me focused on, you know, actually trying to accomplish something here in Tennessee. I volunteered for Harold Ford, even though I disagreed with a lot of his politics. But
he was better than the other guy.
Yeah, exactly.
He was a whole lot better than the other guy.
But,
and that's
the
thing.
Like,
I mean,
the Blue Dog Democrats, even in the local Democratic Party, and they don't even want to listen to anything progressive or liberal from anybody, you know.
But you know what's going to change that is when you and a whole bunch of your friends infiltrate the Democratic Party. I mean, we need to take back the Democratic Party and turn it back into the Democratic Party that it used to be.
I agree.
Yeah. So, Phil, that's my suggestion. And then, you know, as far as, you know, there are members of Congress and members of the United States Senate who represent more than just their district, and they're the ones who are the chairman of the various committees and chairwomen of the various committees. And I would not at all be reluctant to contact, for example, Judiciary now. It's going to be Pat Leahy. He's going to be in charge of it. He's a senator from Vermont. But if something comes up that has to do with Supreme Court nominees or any kind of judicial nominee or a review of the Patriot Act or a review of the Military Commissions Act, I'm living in Oregon. I'll still send a letter to Pat Leahy and say, hey, you represent me because you're chairing a committee that is acting on behalf of all Americans. And they realize that, and they take that seriously. So I wouldn't be at all reluctant to contact, you know, national figures as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, Bernie Sanders, I was thinking of, you know, he's about the most representative of all of us that
I've seen. I wouldn't hesitate to contact Bernie. Phil, thanks a lot for the call. Got to move along. Mark in La Crosse, Wisconsin, you want to try it again?
Yeah, how are you doing?
That sounds pretty good. What's up?
Good. I thought the conversation better.
Oh, no. Mark, it's breaking up again. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's breaking up really bad. We'll try coming back to it again. Jim in Berkeley, California. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, good. How are you doing?
Fine, fine.
I guess I felt a little annoyed this morning with your discussion with Phyllis Schlafly. I was really interested. I wish you would have asked her, do states have the right to enact anti-miscegenation laws, and were the Supreme Court being activist when they struck those laws down in the 60s?
It's a good question, and you're right. I should have asked her that. My guess is that being politically correct, she would say no, but who knows? I just don't know.
Right, but I think that question at that point, you know, it doesn't let her wiggle out of that.
Yeah, I mean, the larger issue is that the folks who are making, setting Phyllis Schlafly aside, broadly speaking, the folks who are making the anti-gay marriage arguments right now are not that dissimilar from the folks who back 40 years ago were making the argument that people of opposite races, different races, should not be allowed to marry, and who 40 years before that were making the argument that women should not be allowed to vote. I mean, it's just there's that worldview that, you know, moves from topic to topic or issue to issue, but is fairly consistent in its worldview.
Yeah, and I think we need to get that message out there.
Yeah,
I agree. Thank you.
I agree. Thanks a lot, Jim. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, TomHartmann.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room and say hello, some of the finest minds on the whole entire Internet. It looks like Mr. Gates, Robert Gates, the new director of the Defense Department, the new Secretary of Defense. Bush is going to keep him on until the end of the year so that Rummy can claim some sort of record. Isn't this bizarre? We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, fair and slightly unbalanced, the Tom Hartmann radio program. The Netherlands and Nordic countries took the top six places in a study of the most democratic nations in the world. This is the intelligence, the Economist Intelligence Unit Index of Democracy. That from the Economist magazine. I mean, this is fascinating. The Netherlands and Nordic countries. So what makes a democracy? What makes a free and fair election process, civil liberties, functioning of government, political participation, and political culture? They looked at 167 countries. The U.S. ranked 17th. The United States and Britain are near the bottom on the full democracy category, but for somewhat different reasons, America falls down in some aspects of governance, and civil liberties, the report said. The lowest scores on a scale of 10 were in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, 1.7, Togo, 1.75, Chad, 1.65, Central Africa, 1.61, and North Korea, 1.03. Interesting. Here we're seeing the countries that have the strongest social safety nets, the social welfare state, beyond ideology. Friedrich von Hayek suggested that high taxation would be the road to serfdom, a threat to freedom itself. Back in the 40s, you know, Friedrich Hayek writing about this. But now we find that those countries that have about 27% of their GDP going to social purposes, the Nordic countries, compared to 17% of GDP in the United States and most other English-speaking countries, are actually more democratic. On average, this is from the Scientific American, on average, the Nordic countries outperform the Anglo-Saxon ones on most measures of economic performance. Poverty rates are much lower. National income per working age population is on average higher. Unemployment rates are roughly the same. The budget situation is stronger in the Nordic group with larger surpluses as a share of GDP. They spend lavishly on research and development and on higher education. Sweden now tops the world's spending on R&D at 4% of GDP. Around 2% in U.S. in English-speaking nations. And also they note labor market policies pay low-skilled and otherwise difficult-to-employ individuals to work in the service sector in key quality-of-life areas such as child care, health, and support for the elderly and disabled. Actually pay them a living wage. Actually respect those kinds of jobs. And what do you end up with? You end up with a stronger democracy. Mike in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
How you doing, Tom? I went and did what you suggested I do. I went out and found people progressively oriented throughout the country, gave them the little bit of money that I had to spread around, gave some to McCaskill, and she won here in Missouri. Got on with the call for change with MoveOn.org. I did more stuff this time than I've ever done in my entire lifetime put together.
Good on you, Mike.
And so my question, now it's my turn.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have a question about your opinion. Is national health care going to happen?
Yeah.
It sounds like the corporations are now against paying for it,
yeah.
And too many people are left out.
Yeah, no, national health care is definitely going to happen. One of the big reasons it's going to happen is because the lack of it is killing General Motors.
Yeah, but on the other hand, Bush has got to be against it.
Of course, and Frist and all these other guys. I mean, well, Frist is on his way out, but you've got a huge leech attached to the back of the American public, in the healthcare system, between the for-profit drug companies operating as unregulated monopolies, essentially, and the health insurance industry, which itself, frankly, in my opinion, has no reason for existence, simply should not exist. I was driving down the street the other day, and I was hearing an ad for an insurance company offering Medicare Plus or Medicare something or other, and it's like, why is an insurance or Medicaid? It's Medicare. Why is an insurance company involved in Medicare? I mean, this is crazy. Can you imagine hearing an ad as you're driving down the street on the radio for a company that says, we'll help you with Social Security? You know, call us and for a small portion of your Social Security benefits, we'll take that money from Social Security and give it to you.
They'll do anything they can when it comes to making money.
I mean, it's nuts. It's absolutely nuts that they have set up, increasingly Medicare and Medicaid are being privatized. It's just crazy. And no, but I there's no doubt in my mind that national health care is coming. No doubt in my mind.
In a couple of years, or
yeah.
need
yeah.
a new president, or what?
Who knows? It's going to be within a few years.
Yeah.
The wind is just too strong. The parade is too loud. You know, the people are here, and it's just. It's all but declared. It's going to happen, Mike. It's just, yeah. But we all have to work on it. Mike, I got to move along. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for your activism this year. It's great to hear from you. Jude in Seattle. Hey, Jude, we have about a minute before we have to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Well, good morning, Tom. I thought it was a perfect segue from the security, prosperity, and partnership for you to share with everyone about the NAFTA superhighway, and I won't keep you on.
Which is part of that, by the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, you know, really housed in the Department of Commerce, and they're trying to organize working groups to, which come out. I mean, it's a whole executive branch. It's bad news.
Yeah. What this is really all about, Jude, is the takeover of sovereign nations by multinational corporations.
Absolutely. And it really ties into the business why the border is not secured, because this is going to be another way to get more people in.
Yeah, well, it even goes beyond that, because we haven't had the border secured for forever. We don't have a secure border with Canada. It's not a problem. The larger issue is who's going to make trade policy for the United States. Is it going to be multinational corporations, or is it going to be representatives of the we, the people?
And it's another way to get rid of our union.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
Thank you,
Jude,
Tom.
Thanks for the call. Yeah. This, you know, oddly, Phyllis Schlafly is right about the prosperity and trade and prosperity agreement for the Americas. It's wrong. It's wrong for the United States. It's wrong for Mexico. It's wrong for Canada. Mostly it's wrong for working people, which is why the corporate cons are all in favor of it, and the populists are up in arms. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So what do we do now that the election is over and the war seems to be winding down? The war I'm referring to, of course, the war that was declared in the early 1980s by Republicans, by Republican operatives. The war against basically the American middle class, the war against the Democratic Party, this whole take-no-prisoners worldview of extreme polarization, extreme demonization, the Lee Atwater strategy, the perpetual campaign strategy, the destroy at all cost, the Limbaugh demonize all things, not us strategy. How do we bring it all together if that war is actually unraveling and unwinding as America faces collectively more serious issues? Like, you know, for example, is today the day that the Great Depression is beginning? The Dow is down 140 some odd points. Gold is up over 640. Oil is up. I mean, a lot happened on Friday. It looks like, and we're going to get into that as we go into the program, but a little later on in the show, I'll tell you about what happened last week. You know, the day after Thanksgiving in Asia with regard to the U.S. dollar and what it means for us. But right now, Anthony Signorella is with us. He's the author of a new book, Call to Liberty. Calltoliberty.net is the website. The subtitle, Bridging the Divide Between Liberals and Conservatives. Tony, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Bridging the divide. First of all, in your book, you suggest that the divide itself is not necessarily a real thing, that it's almost an artifact.
Well, that's right. I mean, the idea that I've had in putting the book together was that it's sort of a manufactured notion. The liberal-conservative divide is something that has been created and that divides us really in an artificial way, meaning that, you know, we demonize liberals, we disenfranchise people who are true conservatives. And the result is that a very small group of people, as you were kind of talking about these, what I call the right-wing operatives or right-wing activists, are able to, because we're all divided, able to really control a whole lot of our political discussion as well as, you know, the politics of the country in general.
Well, I think you go even farther and say that basically the corporatists are able to control the agenda and the country as a whole.
Large
corporations that own our media.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's part of it, though. I think that actually, if you look at it, there's three parts, and I think you've talked about all three of them over time. The corporatists are part of it. A second part of it are, in fact, the neoconservatives who have led with a lot of ideas and fairly ruthless ideas and actions of their own. And then the third wing of that is the Christian fundamentalists who, you know, present really galvanizing ideas to large sections of the population and can help to really trigger the vote for them. But I would note that I mentioned that because I think that they are right-wing rather than Republicans. I work in the small business community, and there's a lot of people who are Republicans who actually feel very disenfranchised by the fact that this relatively small faction has taken over their party.
Oh, sure, yeah. The Jim Jeffords Republicans, as it were.
Yeah, and Christine Todd Whitman and Dave Durenberger, there's many of them.
Yeah. We're talking with Tony Signorelli. He's the author of a new book, Call to Liberty, Bridging the Divide Between Liberals and Conservatives. So how do we do this? I mean, I had a conversation at the beginning of the last hour with Phyllis Schlafly. And what was really odd about that conversation, we started out, you know, talking about gay marriage. And obviously, you know, there's just no way to reconcile our different points of view. And she was of the opinion that, you know, activist judges are promoting a liberal agenda, blah, blah, blah. But then she starts talking about, you know, the merging of the United States into Canada and Mexico with this security and prosperity partnership that Bush is putting together. And, you know, which horrifies me as well. And the loss of national sovereignty to multinational corporations who are trying to pull the strings and run the agenda. And I'm like, Phyllis, you know, we're both populists. We're not talking conservative liberal here. We're talking populism.
Well, that's right. And that is the point. It's populism is part of it. And I think you've also talked a lot, Tom, about principles and the fact that we have traditional principles in America. And I think that a big part of what we need to do is recall those principles, state those principles, and start to recognize that that is, in fact, the common ground. You know, I got started on this when a friend of mine said to me, you know, this right-wing group has a story, and that's how they generate so much interest and so much energy for themselves. And we started thinking, well, what is our story? Well, our story is, in fact, American history. It is, and it is something that all people can, you know, connect to. And there's going to be issues where we can't actually agree or find agreement, like what you were talking about with the gay marriage issue and whatnot. But the underlying point is that we need to be able to discuss the issues in a civil manner. That's the starting point to bridging the divide. Over time, I trust this will happen. You can't do it all in one bit. But if we can change the framework, and instead of, you know, descending into, well, you're a liberal or you're a conservative or, you know, whatever, we can find the common ground, say, well, okay, let's take this idea and measure it against these principles that are time-tested and have been part of who we are as Americans for a long period of time. And there will be great debates about that. We won't always agree, but at least we can have a civil debate.
But, you know, at one point, I mean, we actually had a civil war, you know,
right,
around issues of disagreement. And I don't think that we've come close to civil war since then, frankly, but for example, when Roosevelt ascended in 1932 and became president of the United States with a Democratic majority in both the House and Senate, he was able to get through a whole lot of stuff. But the Republicans were howling and screaming, and they never stopped. I mean, they were calling Social Security socialism. They were, and they still are. It's not like this is new.
No, it's not new. I mean, there have been great debates in our country going way, way, way back, and certainly there's been some of this. But I think that there are parts of it that are new. the amount of the vitriolic aspect to it, the point that where a U.S. Congressman, Jim Gibbon, can actually suggest that liberals should be sent to Iraq to be used as human shields for the military. I mean, these things are getting very outrageous. And really, the point isn't so much the kinds of debate that have to go on, you know, in the normal political process, but really it has to do with what's going on inside our families. You know, we just came off the Thanksgiving weekend, and I think a lot of people probably experienced this thing where politics was off the table in the past, and maybe it was a little bit more on the table this time, but maybe with the people who have voted on the Democratic side, maybe with, you know, wearing a little bit of a gloat after the recent election. And I think that when we, you know, the point is that we need to be able to discuss things at the family level, at the community level, at the local level. And when this, when the debate has become so polarized that we can't even talk about it. In fact, in our families, we often agree we're not going to talk about it. We'd rather keep the peace.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem, because then we're not actually engaging the issues. We're not engaging thought. All we're doing is, in that case, just, you know, avoiding the whole issue, or in other cases,
so what do we do?
One another.
We're talking with Tony Signorelli, his book called Liberty, calledliberty.net, the website. What do we do? I mean, I have conservatives on this program as often as they're willing to come on. A lot of them are afraid to come on, frankly. But, you know, and try to have civil dialogue with them. Are you saying basically the bottom line is that that's what we need to be doing in our lives?
Well, I think it is what we need to be doing in our lives. But I also would caution you, would caution listeners to be a little careful about what we're calling conservatives. There are conservatives who are right wing, which is really outside of the traditions of liberal principle and American principle. That's one set of people.
These are essentially fascists.
So they're being called proto-fascists and all kinds of other names, which is to some extent appropriate given the fact that the movements in the culture, the movements in the country that have occurred since they have come to power actually do mirror historical developments of fascism.
Right. So those are people, the for example, the Pat Robertsons of the world.
Exactly.
Or the Bill Kristols of the world. Those are people that we should shun. We should simply not engage in dialogue.
Well, I think we need to engage them in dialogue, absolutely. But I think that the bigger issue isn't so much that we can't talk with those folks. The bigger issue is that we can't talk with, again, these more moderate Republican people.
Well, that's because the extremists have said you're with us or you're against us. They've set up these giant polarizations and tried to evacuate the middle space.
Well, that's exactly right. And what I'm saying is we need to repopulate the middle space, and we need to repopulate it, I believe, by asserting a new frame. It's not a liberal conservative split. It's American liberal principles that involve conservative, moderate and progressive elements, all of which are absolutely essential for liberalism to flourish.
You're using the language of George Washington, I mean, when he referred to American liberal principles, but the problem is if you use that phrase today, the ditto heads will tear you apart.
The ditto heads will tear you apart, but again, I would say the ditto heads are further down the agenda than trying to talk with the moderate middle and the people who have been either disenfranchised or demonized by this whole dialogue. That's where I think we need to get.
Interesting. Tony Signorelli, the book Call to Liberty, Bridging the Divide Between Liberals and Conservatives, the website calltoliberty.net. Good talking with you, Tony.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Keep up the good work. 16 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
It's your typical liberal. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news. In fact, one of the classic liberal ideas, going back to the founding of this nation, is that when people have money who spend most of their income, that is, when wages go up for the working people of America, the economy is helped. And in fact, what we've been seeing over the last 26 years, ever since Ronald Reagan declared war on the working people in the middle class of the United States, is that wages have basically, well, not basically, have essentially been going down. If you inflation adjusted, wages have been going down or been flat, while the very wealthy have been right off the chart. In fact, today's New York Times, Louis Uchitel, writes this article, the headline, "The Very Rich Are Leaving the Merely Rich Behind." The opportunity to become abundantly rich is a recent phenomenon, not only in medicine, but in a growing number of other professions and occupations. He's talking about people who are making $20, $30, $40, $50 million a year in income. One out of every 825 households earned at least $2 million last year, double the percentage in 1989, adjusted for inflation. So what you're seeing is that the very rich are getting richer. When it comes to wealth, one in every 325 households had a net worth of $10 million or more in 2004. That's four times what it was in 1989. Robert Frank, a Cornell University economist, described the early stages of the phenomenon in his book, The Winner-Take-All Society. And it really has become that. And that's what this article in the Wall Street Journal is all about. But to explain what's going on Wall Street right now, and I think that this is a pretty important one, frankly. There was the blogosphere was buzzing about this over the weekend. A lot of discussion about what's happening in Asia, what's happening with the dollar. Here we have a situation where at this moment, you know, right now the Dow is down 153 points. Now, you know, it'll probably recover somewhat, but the point is that gold is up, oil is up, the Dow is down. What does that mean? People are leaving. They're leaving the Dow. They're leaving dollar-denominated investments to some extent. I mean, this is only a 1.25% drop, so this is nothing momentous yet. But there's something going on here that's large and structural. And my guess is that it's not going to really be obvious for probably 6 months. Although they're holding this thing together with bubblegum and baling wire. And they're doing it so that they can hand off to the Democrats, they being the Republicans and their corporate allies. I mean, keep in mind, if you talk about banking and finance industry, which is, you know, one of the largest and most powerful industries in America, you're talking the Republican Party. If you're talking the oil industry, you're talking the Republican Party. I mean, Dick Cheney goes off to Saudi Arabia to talk about what? Iraq? I don't think so. I believe he's there to talk about oil and the dollar. And he's freaked out. And he well should be freaked out. Because, well, this is a discussion on the blah3.com website. Invictus posted this. He says, one of our readers asked me to post this follow-up comment. The plunge, they're talking about the plunge in the U.S. dollar, how the U.S. dollar on Friday dropped against other currencies all around the world. He says the plunge started after a PBOC official warned the rest of the ASEAN nations. This is the People's Republic of, or the People's, the Communist China official warned the rest of the Asian nations, the Asian trading group nations, that holding dollars wasn't a good idea anymore. He says, this struck me as odd. While it's in conventional wisdom, there really isn't any need to say it, as it would only weaken the dollar position that the Chinese have. Keep in mind, the Chinese are sitting on $1 trillion. Why? Because Ronald Reagan started his starve the beast policy. Because Bill Clinton pushed through NAFTA and GATT. And so the Chinese have ended up, number one, buying an enormous amount of our debt. Where did they get the money to buy that debt? From us. Because we changed our trade policy so that they are now our manufacturing floor. So now when we go to factories, we go to China, they end up with the dollars. We are spending ourselves into debt. Why? Because Reagan and Bush cut taxes on millionaires and billionaires massively. And didn't cut spending at the same time because they, you know, basically couldn't. And there's not that much fat to cut. But they cut the taxes. And so you're running the country into bankruptcy. And what do? You go to the Chinese and borrow money. The Chinese are sitting on $1 trillion. And now they're saying, you know, we're not sure these sitting on these dollars is such a good idea. If they bail out of the dollar is going to crash. And if the dollar crashes, we're talking about a situation like happened in Argentina. I was in Argentina just after the big crash. The Bush daughters are there right now, by the way. Interesting segue, I suppose. But I was in Argentina just after the crash, and it wiped out the middle class. Could we be looking at something like that coming here? And if so, what can we do about it? I'll share a little more about that right after this break. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Well, I got upon a train one day, went to work in my usual way, got some coffee, went to my desk. Suddenly I had this pain in my chest. Oh, no, I said, The boss must be coming. Yeah, the boss walks in, sets herself down, gives what she thinks is a thoughtful frown. She says, "We're in a slump, you know, and as a result, you've got to go. You have been downsized." I said, "Ouch." So as a result of this management stunt, I was unemployed for a couple of months. Found myself another job. Nose to the grindstone, worked like a dog. Then they said, "We've got too much workforce. We got to have a release of resources. This means you." That meant me. So I found myself a crappier job, working for a happier slob. He had an upbeat look in his eyes, even when he said we were being right-sized.
What does that mean? Welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 35 minutes past the hour. Let me just boil this down to the extent that I think I can. There is this global market for investments, basically. The United States represents, you know, an asset base. There's all kinds of, you know, cool stuff here. There's us. There's resources under the ground. Increasingly, our resources are being owned by foreigners because 26 years of conservative economic policies, which includes Clinton's conservative economic policies, from Reaganomics domestically and internationally as well. I mean, right across the board. 26 years of essentially nonstop conservative economic policies have bankrupted America. They've bankrupted us in terms of our trade. They've bankrupted us in terms of our domestic economy. We have right now, every time a baby is born in America, that baby is born with a $28,000 more or less debt. We're broke. We have been on a spending spree ever since Ronald Reagan first started using the credit card of the U.S. Treasury to try and make the economy look good. And hopefully, as David Stockman pointed out in his book after he left the Reagan administration, David Stockman, the director of Office of Management and Budget, the guy who put all this together for Reagan, their plan, their hopeful plan, was to create such a financial crisis, to put the government so far in debt that everybody would go, "Oh, my God, we can't have, what, a $2 trillion debt? We can't afford that. We've got to do away with something. Let's cut Medicare. Let's get rid of aid to student loans. Let's get rid of federal housing assistance. Let's do away with food stamps. Let's get rid of, you know, let's stop funding public libraries." All these socialist programs that the cons love to hate. Let's replace them all with corporations. Let's let corporations take care of all these things. And then it'll be like it was in the 1890s. And America was much more stable then, wasn't it? People knew their place, after all. So this is the agenda. In the process, in these 26 years, we have gone from being the wealthiest nation in the world to being the most indebted. We are even in debt to Mexico. We have gone from being the largest manufacturer of finished goods in the world. We made more stuff and sold it outside our country than any other country in the world when Reagan became president. But since Reagan's presidency, after 26 years of conservative economic policies and these insane trade policies, we have now become the world's largest importer of finished goods. In fact, from where I'm broadcasting right here in Portland, Oregon, it's raining out. In fact, it might be snowing out. It was snowing a little earlier when we got up this morning, when we walked in this morning at 4 o'clock in the morning, 3:30 in the morning. Our dock, we live on a river. We live in a house that floats on the river. And the dock, which is about 3 inches above the river level, so it's kind of at sea level, was frozen. It was like slippery. And it was a wild walk, you know, coming. Because if you slip and you fall into the water, the water's moving about 3 feet per second. And it's cold enough that you're dead in about 6 minutes from hypothermia. And there's no guardrails. And it was awful dark. But in any case, walking in this morning, as the snow is falling here in Oregon, for that matter, the river that I was walking along, that rain, that river, contained toxic amounts of methyl mercury. So toxic that you've got to be careful about how much fish you eat. Now, that's true of every place in the United States. But in a lot of parts of the United States, like the Midwest or the East, when I used to live in Vermont, for example, there's massive amounts of mercury in the rivers in Vermont. And that's mostly coming from the smokestacks of the Midwest, of coal-fired power plants in Ohio and Michigan and Illinois, Indiana. And, you know, they blow this stuff up into the air and it settles to the ground in New England. But here in Oregon, we're getting twice as much mercury in our water from China as we are from local sources. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre. Our air is fresh enough that the oil companies, the gas refiners, are mixing toxic waste, benzene, one of the toxic wastes that's produced in the refining of gasoline. They have to take it out for the gasoline down that's sold down in Los Angeles because the air is bad there, so you can't have benzene in the gas. So they take it out there. They add it in to our gas up here, along with close to 100 other toxic chemicals, because it's cheaper than sending it off to a toxic waste disposal site. So the toxic waste disposal site is our cars. But in any case, the bigger point that I was making is it's all coming from China. Why is it coming from China? Because China has become the factory floor for America with no emission standards. So here we are now, having exported most of our manufacturing, having an economy based on, you want fries with that? And let me roll you over and give you a shot in the butt. You know, I mean, basically health care and fast food. That's where we're at now. Let's feed each other. Let's care for each other. Well, at a certain point, somebody's got to make something. So 26 years of insane conservative economic policies bankrupted America. And the only thing that's keeping the dollar strong, the only thing that's causing the rest of the world to continue loaning us money, is the fact that if you want to buy oil, you have to have dollars. Because the worldwide market in oil is denominated in dollars. If the worldwide market in oil were to change from dollars to, say, euros, then suddenly there'd be no demand for dollars. Or, you know, not no demand, but let's say it would drop by 15 or 20%. That would be enough to wipe out the United States. We would have a situation here. It would be worse than when the peso crashed in Mexico in the 80s. It would be at least as bad as what happened when I forget the name of their currency in Argentina. It's the peso. Thank you, Alex. As bad as when the peso crashed in Argentina. And so what happened? The International Bank, the World Bank, comes in and says, okay, kill your social programs. In Chile, they privatized Social Security. What happened? It was a disaster. The banks made a lot of money. It destroyed their Social Security program. When I was in Argentina back about 5-6 years ago after the crash, as they were starting to put the country back together after the crash, I wrote about this in Common Dreams. It must have been 3 or 4 years ago. When I was down there in middle-class neighborhoods, you'd see furniture and TV sets and stuff out in the front yard, people selling them so that they could continue to make their house payments. The economy had been wiped out. By what? By the exact same thing we're doing, driving the country into debt in order to try and kill social programs, conservative economic policies. So the Chinese are looking at this situation and going, you know, we're cutting deals with Iran and with Russia. Russia controls a quarter of the world's oil. A quarter. Okay, and the Chinese are cutting a deal with them. And then you've got Iran, which has more oil than Iraq. And Dick Cheney, of course, about Iraq.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
So if the Chinese can cut a deal with Iran and with Russia, and if Iraq falls under the control of Iran, which it looks like it may have already done, frankly. It's certainly moving in that direction, at least economically. Then the Chinese don't need the dollar. Because they can just work out trades. Yeah, we'll use rubles. Yeah, we'll use euros. We'll use renminbi. We'll use yuan, you know, the Chinese currency. And so what are they doing? They're divesting themselves of dollars. And this is what happened on Friday, was the Asians started dumping dollars. In fact, this blog over at by Invictus over at Blah 3, he says, I believe this may have been a heads up. He's talking about this statement that was made on Thursday by the Chinese officials saying, you know, dollar isn't such a good thing to hold. He says, I believe this may have been a heads up to China's partners that the dollar was going to be sold off soon and they should get rid of as many as they can to minimize losses, which would benefit China in the long run by keeping the regional trade flow moving, even though they take a wealth hit short term. He says, if I'm correct, then the Chinese will start unwinding their dollar position shortly and economic dominoes will start falling. Iran wants the oil markets to deal exclusively in euros, not dollars anymore. This would be disastrous for anyone with holdings in dollars like us. And so what does the vice president of the United States, and Warren Buffett, by the way, the savviest and wealthiest investor in the United States, he has publicly said, this was 6 months ago, he's moving pretty much everything out of dollars. And so what does the vice president of the United States do? He gets on a plane and goes to Saudi Arabia. Why? Maybe to beg them to keep oil denominated in dollars. Because if it's not, we're going to see an incredible crash. As it is, I think, you know, we're getting close to the end of the ride. Now the question, what can we do about it? And how can we prevent the Republicans from saying that it was all the Democrats' fault? Because I guarantee you, that's what's coming next. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America. The Dow coming back. It's only down 139 points right now. But anyhow, the bottom line, just to summarize our last screed, is that if this thing starts to unravel quickly, it's really important that we get out there and point out that this is the direct consequence of 26 years of conservative economic policies, destroying the economic infrastructure of this country, destroying the manufacturing infrastructure, destroying the debt infrastructure. Ford Motor Company right now has just this is the New York Times, I mean, posted just minutes ago, for the first time in its 103-year history, the Ford Motor Company is mortgaging its assets, including factories, equipment, office buildings, patents, and trademarks, and its stakes in subsidiaries like Volvo in order to raise $18 billion. The amount Ford is borrowing exceeds the total market value of all its outstanding stock by more than $2 billion. That's like you have a net worth of $100,000, so you go out and you borrow $120,000. They are throwing themselves totally in debt. Why? This refinancing tells us they see very tough times ahead, says John Casesa, a veteran automotive analyst. Either they're incredibly conservative or they're preparing for an extremely dark outlook. So what we have to do is get out in front of this thing, particularly with regard to publicity, and talk about how this is the result of these insane conservative policies coming home to roost. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, our senior jet lag correspondent.
I just flew in from London, so excuse me while I brush some polonium 210 off my salad.
Have they found polonium? Any, you know, I know that they found like trace amounts of it, but how's that story playing out right now?
Well, right now that they are officially saying that it's polonium 210,
right.
And everybody is saying it very proudly as though they'd heard of it before, you know.
Right. Oh yeah, I knew what that was.
Exactly.
I remember the periodic table. Let's see, that's an actinide, right? Or is that one of the superactinides? No, it's an actinide.
People are riveted. Once Tom Cruise actually got married, they really, really started concentrating on this, as only the British press can do.
Because
it's got everything, hasn't it? It's got spies. It hasn't got any sex yet, but they're trying to dig some up.
Well, and Putin is not coming out well in this.
He really isn't. I mean, the Kremlin says it's nonsense that it was involved in any way. And I sort of thought to myself, right. And the Kremlin tells us the truth, you know.
Yeah, they have a long history of that, actually.
That's right.
Just ask Leon Trotsky.
It was an ice pick, wasn't it, that got him in the
Yeah, end. Yeah. Exactly. For that matter, I mean, you could ask the Tsarina. So how do you think that's going to... I mean, this is kind of a digression from everything we've been talking about, but this is...
It's kind
an
of
example.
Like relief.
Well, and in a way, and in a way, it also, I think, should give us all pause, because what's happening is that Russia is becoming the Soviet Union again. It is becoming another czarist state in many regards. I mean, Vlad Putin is, if accounts are accurate, is a man of very little consideration or concern for human life.
He does seem to be, and seems to have no trouble with being known that way, yet he's still President Bush's friend, and has no trouble either, by the way, saying straight to Bush's face, as he has on two occasions now, that he has no interest in the kind of democracy that we're trying to build in Iraq.
Right, right.
Which I thought was fascinating that he just flat out said that in front of Bush. Now, it's possible that Putin's not involved. It's possible that there are rogue elements within the FSB, which is what the KGB became, because it is a pre-rogue organization, and then there are breakaway groups from that. So,
but Putin used to be the head of it.
Sorry?
Putin used to be the head of it.
Putin was the head of the KGB, that's right.
I mean, that's the thing to keep in mind, is that the guy who's president of Russia right now used to be the head of the KGB. Just like, by the way, the guy who's president of the United States, his daddy used to be the head of the CIA.
Scary stuff, isn't it?
It gets weirder and weirder.
Both sides.
So, anyhow, what else is happening in Washington, D.C. and in the world?
Well, the Iraq study group is meeting today. Well, first of all, the president's off to Estonia and then to Latvia for the NATO summit and then to Jordan, where he hopes to meet with the prime minister of Iraq. And the.
Do you think Maliki's going to defy Sadr and show up, or do you think Sadr's going to back down?
I think Maliki's going to show up. But I'm notoriously wrong at this kind of guess.
Well, if he shows up and Sadr does pull out, then there won't be an Iraqi government any longer.
Exactly.
So he'll show up. The Iraqi government will fall. There will be an absolute power vacuum. There'll be nothing to go back to. And he goes into exile in London and lives like Ahmed Chalabi did or something.
Which is not a bad way of life at all.
Yeah.
If that's what he fancies. I mean, he could come up with any number of reasons why he couldn't get out. He could have a curfew once again, and he could not be able to make it to the airport. Jalal Talabani had that problem.
Yeah. Just can't make it to my own airport. Gee,
yeah,
what do I do?
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, especially when you run the country. It's my airport.
It's an extraordinary situation for a prime minister to be in.
NBC and MSNBC are now officially referring to what is going on in Iraq as a civil war. Has the BBC been doing this for some time? How is the rest of the world press dealing with this? And how long do you think it's going to be before the rest of the U.S. media begins to refer to it as a civil war?
I do not think it's going to be very long. I think a lot of them are going to follow the lead. I noticed that the Washington Post today referred to it as either this or a civil war. So it's creeping into the lexicon.
Yeah. And I notice also Chris Matthews has stopped referring to it as the war in Iraq. He's calling it the occupation of Iraq. Hopefully that's
a meme. You listen to your show.
Yeah, there you go. Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria, for the report today.
Thank you.
Get some sleep. glad you made it back in one piece. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up next, Everything You Know Is Wrong. The Art of Original Thinking. Stick around.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Our quote for the day from Mahatma Gandhi. There's a higher court than courts of justice, and that is the court of conscience. It supersedes all other courts. You know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, as Don Rumsfeld famously said. Sometimes you don't know that you don't know what you don't know, and sometimes even what you think you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync, and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Jan Phillips has some thoughts on how you know what you know. The Art of Original Thinking is her book, The Making of a Thought Leader. Jan Phillips, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Tell us, what is a thought leader?
A thought leader is somebody who's been able to clarify that what comes out of their mouth as a product of their own thinking is original and unique to them and not an inherited voice from somewhere else.
That seems like a pretty rare thing. Aren't most people synthesizers, really? Isn't creativity not an original process, but a synthetic process in as much as it's taking, you know, various pieces and synthesizing them into something that is arguably new?
Yes, and I think that's the original act. The act of synthesis is the creative act. And so a thought leader would be able to take in opposing viewpoints, for example, and not register that as something coming from the enemy, but register that as an opportunity to fire up new neurons in our own brains. And, you know, have an actual creative collision with a different kind of thinking so that what we synthesize is a higher modality of thought and consciousness in the world. And I love that Mahatma Gandhi quote, by the way. That was fabulous.
Thank you, Jen. Jan Phillips, the author of the book, The Art of Original Thinking, her website, janphillips.com. Jan, you talk about the importance of original thinking and being a thought leader. What about folks who don't aspire to leadership or originality? They really would just like to carry on with their lives and have a normal day and do their work and go home at night and have a beer and watch TV. And I mean, is there anything wrong with that?
Well, you know, Rumi commented on that, and basically what he said about it is let them sleep. But I just feel like our world is in a perilous time right now, and I'm not really too comfortable with letting everybody sleep while Rome is burning. So I also feel that it's not so much a matter of compelling people into action, which would be alien to something that serves them, but you're really inviting people into a more meaningful life by asking questions that have them explore their own destiny and mission and sources of joy in the world. And I think what happens is people really find that we want to be of use. That's what really does make our lives meaningful.
And without devolving into New Age woo-woo or psychobabble, I mean, make this practical.
Well, I was riding in a car the other day with this guy who I happened to be in a car with because our plane was diverted from San Diego to L.A. So we split a rental car and we're driving down the road. And we've got 2 hours in the car, and he laments to me that he's probably in his late 20s, and he works in a corporate environment. He's a big computer guru. And he's disenchanted because everybody in his age group seems to only care about acquisitions and material well-being and becoming a millionaire. And he really has some deeper values going on, and he feels reticent to speak of his values because everybody is only talking about materialism and wealth. And I asked him a few questions about, well, does he ever initiate conversations based on his own values? And he says no, because he's already concluded that because nobody else talks about values, nobody else cares about values. And I think that is unoriginal thinking.
That's a dangerous conclusion.
What's that?
It's a dangerous conclusion.
It is.
It's probably a faulty one.
Because every time I have opened up my mouth in public and said what I feel from my heart, people really are relieved. And they go, oh, it's almost like in those old cowboy films when one cowboy would put his guns on the table and the other cowboy would put his guns on the table and then they could do their work together. And right now people are pretty, you know, armored up. And the only thing that gets people back to the level of the heart and back to the level of the soul and the spirit is when somebody self-discloses and has the courage to bring up a meaningful conversation. And then what predictably follows is, a conversation of consequence. Where, you know, what I have to go first in order to have even in my own family, no meaningful conversations occur if I don't initiate them. And that's what being a thought leader is. It's like being a conversation wrangler.
Yeah.
You know, who wants to have a boring conversation?
Nobody, frankly. And so if we have two people of goodwill, this makes perfect sense. But what happens when you're trying to have a conversation with somebody who either has a hidden agenda that is a win-lose agenda? They're at odds with you. They see you as an opportunity to win something, to get something, to, you know, whatever. They're in a win-lose mode of thinking. Or somebody who views the interchange as sports. In other words, it's my team, your team, and I'm going to win, and you're going to lose, or you're going to win, and I'm going to lose, or whatever. And it's not even about getting something or gaining something. It's simply about, you know, planting the flag and declaring, ah, ta-da, my philosophy has triumphed. And they have really no interest in this kind of introspective analysis that you're talking about.
And we know there's plenty of people like that around. You know, and I've really made it a point now, especially after reading Surowiecki's book, The Wisdom of the Crowds, I've made it a point to have in my circle individuals who are as much the opposite of me as I can get. In fact, my first reader, the first email I would send out when I'd finished a chapter to this book will go to a man who is as much my opposite as I could find. And he's in every way opposite. He's in his 70s. He's a multimillionaire. He's a staunch Republican. He's a, you know, conservative Jew. And his values always, when we talk, appear to be very different from mine. And my commitment in writing this book was to write a book that would not alienate anybody. So I used no labels. I said no mean things, and I only shined a light on who was doing it right. So to have this man be the reader of my book and get it by him, even though I myself, I mean, we don't want to use labels much in this world, but all of my roots are progressive and liberal. If anybody wanted to classify me, they would certainly not put me anywhere near the right. And so here I am sending my book chapters off to a man who's really opposite mine. And he loved the book, and he could take no issue with anything that I said. And I have lunch with him, you know, once every few weeks just to keep my thinking sharp. Because when I'm with people who all think like me, I don't learn much. You know, I'm not challenged. But when I'm with a man or a woman who thinks really opposite me, that's an opportunity for me to be great. You know, it's like sharpening the knife of my mind.
And it's not great in terms of, hey, I can knock them upside the head and show that I'm, it's great in terms of
clarifying my values.
Yeah.
I get really clear on how do I feel about this Iraq war? How do I feel about terrorism? How do I feel about, you know, the Catholic Church? You know, I'm an ex-nun, you know, and just this morning I'm looking at a website that, you know, the people are considering me coming in and speaking. Mm-hmm. And one of the speakers is Phyllis Schlafly, you know,
who I interviewed on this program 2 hours ago.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, my
God. Yeah, she was on this program. She was on this program
for
15 minutes. We opened the program with her.
And when I saw that, I immediately experienced a kind of soul stretching, because the old habitual dualistic thinking is, oh my God, I don't want to be on the same stage with somebody who represents what she represents. But when I remounted my slope of thought, I thought, wait a minute, this is a great opportunity to build a bridge, because nobody's building bridges. You know, there's a huge lot of stuff coming out of the left, a huge lot coming out of the right, but nobody's connecting the two, and that's what my role is this time around in this lifetime. My role is to be a bridge builder. So the opportunity of speaking with and next to Phyllis Schlafly, suddenly it arose like a real privilege to have that position.
Yeah, I feel the same. I feel the same way about all the conservatives I have on this program. In fact, I far more often have people on with whom I disagree than with whom I agree, for essentially the same reasons, which might be why I'm in your book. Is that because you disagree with me or you agree with me?
You're in my book because you did some very important research, and what you uncovered about the corporation as persons, I think, is important research, and I want to just continue to get that out, because if people are clear about that...
Jan, I have to wrap it up, but I appreciate your kind words. The Art of Original Thinking is the book, The Making of a Thought Leader, JanPhillips.com. Jan Phillips, thanks. 16 minutes past the hour. welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 21 minutes past the hour. Our phone number, 866-440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, hang out with some of the finest minds on the entire internet. Yes, it's easy. It's free. Just drop by. No, seriously. What is the world coming to? First, this is Janie Haar writing in the Oregonian, the newspaper, the statewide newspaper here in Oregon. First, U.S. companies took their operations overseas. Then they uprooted their call centers. Now, an Oregon legislator has joined the outsourcing trend by hiring a company from India to write a speech for him. Yes, politicians can now go to India. This is Senator Frank Morris, Republican from Albany. He had a speech on globalization that he was giving to the Friends of the Albany Public Library, and it was written by a company in Bangalore, India. Well, I guess it's appropriate for a Republican politician. Maybe we should just outsource the politicians themselves. The Republican Party moves to India. I mean, it seems pretty straightforward. Meanwhile, the Bush administration, speaking of Republicans and Republican Party, the Bush administration getting hysterical. They're having hissy fits. This Dan Frumkin blogging or noting or whatever over at the WashingtonPost.com. After nearly 4 years of letting the Bush administration set the terms of the national debate over Iraq, some major news organizations are finally calling the conflict there what it is, a civil war. The White House is howling in protest. Here's what Matt Lauer announced on NBC's Today Show this morning. Quote, as you know, for months now, the White House has rejected claims that the situation in Iraq has deteriorated into civil war, and for the most part, news organizations like NBC have hesitated to characterize it as such. But after careful consideration, NBC News has decided the change in terminology is warranted, that the situation in Iraq with armed militia militarized factions fighting for their own political agendas can now be characterized as a civil war. End quote. And the response was swift. NBC says the White House is objecting this morning to two descriptions of the Iraq conflict as a civil war. Yeah, gee, surprise, surprise. But a civil war is what it is. There's no other way to say it. There's no other way to characterize it. It's just that simple. And it's just, frankly, that tragic. I mean, that's what has happened. In fact, let's take a quick look at what's happened with the U.S. occupation during the Civil War in Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Security developments in Iraq as of 11:30 a.m. GMT on Monday. This is from Reuters. Dateline Tal Afar. Clashes erupted between gunmen and police during the night, killing three policemen and one gunman. In Baghdad, the bodies of five people were found with gunshot wounds bearing signs of torture. In Baijiam, a police major was killed while he was trying to dismantle a roadside bomb. In Baghdad, gunmen attacked a Baghdad municipal office in central Baghdad and killed a guard and abducted three others. In Ramadi, U.S. forces killed two suspected insurgents on Sunday. On Baghdad, the U.S. military said three of its soldiers were killed and two others wounded by insurgents. In Dujail, gunmen attacked a checkpoint near that city, 90 kilometers north of Baghdad, kidnapped eight policemen, police said. In Ramadi, U.S. military said four Iraqi civilians were wounded, including three boys ages 6, 13, and 16, when mortar bombs fired by U.S. forces against insurgents hit them. The occupation continues. 1-866-440-8466. David in San Francisco. Hey, David, welcome to the program. David? You there, David?
Oh, yeah, I'm right here.
Yeah, so what's up?
Oh, sorry, Tom. Yeah, I was interested. I was listening to the discussion of whether or not people like Phyllis Schlafly are honest brokers for... I don't know how to, whether or not to even...
Their worldview, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, I was brought up in St. Louis where Phyllis Schlafly was, considered to be somewhere in between organized crime and a Nazi. She, when Yellow Submarine came out in the 1960s, she was active in making sure that that it was banned from the theaters in St. Louis. So I've always taken the position that she's a saboteur, and she has no decision making ability to broker any kind of peace or any kind of worldview that has anything other than rapacious greed tied to it. So I've always, at the same time, looked
and yet
at,
there's a constituency for that worldview, David.
Well,
I mean, that's the tragedy of it.
I think I urged you to interview a guy named Martin Lee before. He wrote a book called The Beast Reawakens.
Yes, Martin Lee and I have a very good friend in common, and we've met and we've talked, and I have The Beast Reawakens at home,
right,
about the rise of Germany.
If you watch the movie, the movie about the Nuremberg trials, it's very clear that the Nazis did not quietly shut down after World War II.
I don't disagree with you at all. 27 minutes past the hour. Free speech zone, the real free speech zone, the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. Remember the story about John Kerry's $1,000 haircut? It was on Drudge for a few days, and, you know, it circulated through the blogosphere, and it was full of, well, according to reliable sources and insight, it turned out it was not true. Remember when Bill Clinton got a haircut on Air Force One? As it sat on the tarmac at LAX, he actually did. He actually did get a haircut on Air Force. Well, Air Force One is basically a flying, apartment building or something? It's got it has bedrooms and bathrooms and showers. And it's, a 747 is a great big huge airplane devoted essentially to, one person's comfort. I mean, it's just pretty massive. So he got a haircut. It did not slow down traffic at LAX. In fact, presidents get haircuts on Air Force One all the time. This is not at all unusual. But the right-wingers took that haircut and turned it into a whole giant smear campaign. In fact, if you Google Clinton haircut, you'll find all kinds of them. And, in fact, it took on a life of its own to the point that Newsday had to apologize, as did the Los Angeles Times. Here's what Newsday reported. At 4:30 in the afternoon on Tuesday, and there's a reason why I'm telling you this story, which I will get to in just a second, which has to do with things happening in Hawaii and Argentina. At 4:30 in the afternoon on Tuesday, May 18th, this is 1993, President Bill Clinton boarded Air Force One, a Los Angeles internet at LAX, after playing a game of basketball with children in the city. Waiting for him there was Christophe, a renowned hairdresser of Belgian extraction who catered to Hollywood stars and had, on occasion, cut Hillary Clinton's hair. At 4:52, the Secret Service and airport officials closed two of the airport's four runways, as is customary when Air Force One takes off and lands. A few minutes later, they requested a delay of 20 minutes. Meanwhile, Christophe cut Clinton's hair. Air Force One took off at exactly 5:48. Air traffic came and went on time, with the exception of one unscheduled air taxi, which took off 17 minutes after leaving the gate, 2 minutes late. The bare fact that the president had had a haircut on Air Force One was reported the next day by Reuters. On that day also, Valerie Kuklinski, a reporter with the L.A. Bureau of UPI, called Ellie Brecky, a spokeswoman for the FAA in Los Angeles, to ask whether the president's haircut had delayed air traffic. Brecky stated that the aircraft control tower had told her that the arrival of two incoming flights, one from Arizona, the other from Palmdale, California, had been delayed. On the 20th, Kuklinski's findings were released, and Lois Romano of the Washington Post revealed that the hairdresser had been Christophe and that the fees were in the $200 range. The two critical elements of the story, the airport delays, which actually didn't happen, and the high price of the haircut, the two wings, so to speak, on which the story would fly were now in place. After that, Glenn Kessler of this newspaper, that's Newsday, filed a Freedom of Information request for information about delays. Some 5 weeks later, he got his answer, which revealed that, in fact, there had been none. In the meantime, however, the story of the haircut, including the misinformation regarding delays, had winged its way around the world. Now, that's how Newsday apologized for dealing with the Clinton haircut LAX delay myth that was promoted by Drudge and all the right-wing websites. So Bill Clinton gets a haircut, and the right-wingers go hysterical. Can you imagine what would have happened if somebody had died on Air Force One while Bill Clinton was getting his haircut? Particularly if he was on his way to, oh, say, a fundraiser? Well, this from the Associated Press. A motorcycle officer injured last week while escorting President Bush on the Hawaiian Islands died Sunday, police said. Steve Favela, 30, and two other officers crashed their cycles as the presidential motorcade was traveling across Hickam Air Force Base to meet troops for breakfast early Tuesday. The other officers were treated at the Queens Medical Center and released. Favela, an 8-year veteran of the Honolulu Police Department and father of four, had suffered internal injuries and had been in critical condition at the medical center. Light rain had been falling in the partly cloudy morning of the crash, and some roads on the base were slick. Members of the White House medical team, including an ambulance, were cut loose in the motorcade to help. Bush, however, kept going. Didn't stop. Two guys crashed, two motorcycles in his escort crash. One of the guys dies. Bush keeps on going. He spent the night on the base on his way back from a trip to Indonesia and Vietnam. Can you imagine what the right wing would do if this had been Bill Clinton? I mean, just think about it for a minute. On another note, Joe Goldman is a reporter for ABC News. He had heard that the Bush twins, Jenna and Barbara, were down in Buenos Aires, Argentina, celebrating their 25th birthday, which is this week. Party ain't hard. So 3 days ago, he reported on ABC News, abcnews.com is where it was reported. He reported that he was at an international event. As I recall, it was a correspondence dinner of some kind. And he thought, hey, let's go check this out. We're in the neighborhood where it is said that Barbara and Jenna Bush are staying, in an upscale boutique hotel. Now, this is after the news had been reported a few days before that, that first daughter Barbara had been robbed, that her purse had been snatched in a restaurant. So he's at this correspondence dinner with like 100 people from all over the world. There could be terrorists, there could be anybody, who knows? In a residential neighborhood in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and with a couple of other reporters, and he says, you know, this is the neighborhood where they say that the Bush twins are staying. Why don't we just walk around and see if we can find the hotel they're in? So they go out, Joe Goldman and a couple of other people, they go out and they walk down the street, and sure enough, here's a little boutique hotel, one of these, you know, 10, 12, 15-room hotels. And the front of the hotel is solid glass. It's a wall of glass. You can see in. You can see into the lobby. And sitting there on the sofa is Jenna Bush getting her email on her laptop. There's two or three other girls her age, young women, 20 in their early 20s. Sitting around, and Barbara Bush is sitting over in, by the wall. No security that he can see at all. So he says, hey, let's check this out. He walks up to the hotel, expecting the Secret Service to leap out and grab him. Instead, the doorman opens the door and says, welcome, sir. He walks in. He walks over to Barbara Bush, the younger, sticks out his hand and says, you're Barbara Bush. And she says, she shakes his hand and she says, yes, I am. Now, it could have been that his hand was covered with polonium 240 or 120 or 110 or whatever it is. But it wasn't. He was a good guy. He's a reporter for ABC News. He said, "You having a good time here in Argentina?" And she said, "Yeah, got to go." And she and the girls, you know, leave and go upstairs to their room. A few minutes later, they leave the hotel and they go to a restaurant down the street. And they're just sitting there in the restaurant having dinner. So he reports this on ABC News. So now today, the U.S. ambassador to Argentina, newly appointed guy, by the way, he's new on his job. Anthony Wayne is his name, no relation to Bruce, otherwise known as Batman. Bad joke, sorry. Anyhow, U.S. Ambassador Anthony Wayne is a little miffed. There was supposed to be publicity about his arriving in the country. It's been upstaged by all the stories about Barbara and Jenna. And so the U.S. Embassy officials are, quote, strongly suggesting, end quote, that President Bush's twin daughters, Jenna and Barbara Bush, cut short their trip to Buenos Aires because of security issues. Yeah, like Joe Goldman can just walk up and say, "Hi, you're Barbara Bush, aren't you?" and grab her hand. Officials say the media coverage upstaged publicity plans for the new U.S. ambassador. Yeah, I told you that. Neither the White House nor the U.S. Embassy in Buenos Aires responded to requests for comment. The Argentinian press blitz followed a report on the blotter last week that Barbara Bush's person's cell phone was stolen last weekend while dining at the popular San Telmo outdoor marketplace, despite being guarded by the Secret Service. Stories of the twins' visit took on wild proportions in the Argentinian press. One tabloid headline had the young women running nude in the hallway of their hotel. So the U.S. Embassy is going, "Hey, wait a minute. All over Argentina, the newspapers are reporting that these two, the daughters of the president, are staying in this hotel in this neighborhood, running around naked, talking to reporters. Do we have a security issue here? Isn't their daddy the guy who says, 'Be afraid, be very afraid'? Isn't he the one who's always talking about those evil terrorists, and we got to worry about you know, that they're coming to get us and all that kind of stuff? I mean,
be afraid. Yeah. September the 11th, we saw tragedy arrive.
Isn't that their daddy? I mean,
the evil terrorists. Danger.
And they're just walking around. Well, the U.S. Embassy says, man, maybe they shouldn't be just walking around, but they just said, "Hey, we're indestructible. We're Bushes." 45 minutes past the hour.
A song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts onto the shoreline. And the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ships come in. And the sands will roll out a carpet of gold for your weary toes to be a touching. And the ship's wise men will remind you once again that the whole wide world is watching.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. So I wonder, you know, if Chelsea Clinton was partying hard while her dad was president and refused to take the advice of the U.S. Embassy and get a little security or get out of town. And, you know, and her dad, and if Bill Clinton had a guy who was protecting him just die and he just drove off and ignored it. How would the Reich Wing deal with that? How would right-wing talk radio deal with it? I suspect that there would be no end of it. I suspect that for the next 6 months, we'd be having investigations. Speaking of how the right wing deals with things, Fox News, good old Chris Wallace. Remember when Bill Clinton slapped him down, said, you know, you're just putting out your right wing talking points. Well, this time Barney Frank slapped him down. This is actually an interesting interchange. They're talking about L.C. Hastings, but here's the context. Here's
quite
the
honest. You said that Pelosi's effort to put Murtha in as her number two, John Murtha, over Steny Hoyer was, as you put it, an error in judgment. Would it be an error in judgment to name Alcee Hastings to the House Intel Committee?
So here's Chris Chris Wallace sets the question up by saying, well, you've been in conflict before with Nancy Pelosi, and would this be a conflict? You know, in other words, it's like trying to draw blood, you know, it's pointing out past conflicts. So Barney Frank just calls him on it.
No, I don't think so. Although, Chris, I got to say, you have an odd view of balance. I just been listening, and every single question you asked, you said it's to see what the Democrats are going to be like. We're all prepared to talk about a very positive agenda we have in tax fairness and environmental concerns and housing. And, of course, all of your questions have been aimed at trying to find points of controversy.
And then he goes on to point out that, L.C. Hastings may have had some problems. So does Newt Gingrich, who works for Fox News and is talking about running for president.
Are not going to be high on our agenda. Now, having said that, I would say this. Alcee Hastings has served in the Congress for a long time, since the events that were the cause of the impeachment. I think he's entitled to be judged on how those have worked. People do make mistakes. You know, I see Newt Gingrich listed as a Republican presidential candidate. He was twice reprimanded by the House of Representatives Ethics Committee for misbehavior. So when things have happened far in the past and people have had a different record, I think we can look at it. But again, I am struck by the tenor of your questions.
And then he does it one more time. Here's Barney Frank. He one more time slaps down Chris Wallace. And you got to hear Chris Wallace at the end of this. All of a sudden he starts going, ah.
You advertise this as giving us a chance to talk about what we're going to do, but everything is aimed at trying to put us in a kind of a bad light and look at the most controversial and not very representative thing that we plan to do.
Well, and let me see if I can do better, Congressman Frank. Let's do a...
I really didn't expect you to actually point out that there's somebody behind that curtain, So yeah, in fact.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Yeah, that's Chris Wallace's mantra. By the way, minimum wage is going up in Illinois to $7.50 an hour. On November 16th, the Illinois State Senate, this is Think Progress, approved a $1 increase in the state minimum wage, putting it at $7.50. It's going to go into effect on July 1st, and then will increase every year to account for inflation. Conservatives are hysterical. They're saying this is going to cut jobs and all this kind of thing. But the Fiscal Policy Institute, back in March, did an analysis of this. And they said the following. This report examined recent state-by-state trends for small businesses employing fewer than 50 workers and found that employment and payrolls in small businesses grew faster in the states with minimum wages above the federal level than in the remaining states where the $5.15 an hour federal minimum wage prevailed. You get that? Those states, like Oregon, for example, the minimum wage here is at $7.25, I think, and maybe it's gone up to $7.35. And what happened when we increased our minimum wage in Oregon? The number of people employed actually went up. The report also found that total job growth was faster in the higher minimum wage states. Faster job growth also occurred in the retail trade sector, the sector of the economy employing the most workers at low wages, at a faster rate than in the minimum wage states, in the lower minimum wage state. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, badly constructed sentence there. St. Louis Post-Dispatch notes, Illinois' minimum wage was last raised in 2003 to $6.50 an hour. At that level, a mother working full-time to support her child makes $13,500 a year. Just basically about the poverty line. Bottom line here, if you give money to people who are going to spend it, you will stimulate the economy. We are back to, and we really need to be having a discussion and a debate in the United States. And perhaps we can get into this. We're going to restart our online NLP classes, neuro-linguistic programming, the use of language, the use of, how can you use language in ways that are powerful and persuasive and effective? How's this done? What is the code that can be unlocked, the secret code for communication? And one of the things that we really need to be focusing that code and those efforts on is the classic economic idea that if you make sure that people who spend all the money that they get, which is basically the working class of America, that if you make sure that people who spend the majority of the money that they get more money, then more money goes into the economy. It's just that simple. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging conservative Mark Morano about his concerns about a new United Nations children's book. He says it's promoting fear of global warming. Oh, my God. That and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, always remember, activism begins with you, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.